Music commentary for broadcast by the Philadelphia Orchestra is by the orchestra's associate conductor, William Smith, and is based on notes by Richard Fried, program annotator for the Philadelphia Orchestra. Now, here is William Smith.
While Bruckner's symphonies have been performed fairly consistently since his own time, it is only in the last 30 years or so that they and the symphonies of Gustav Mahler have taken their place in the international permanent repertory, thereby changing the status of the two composers from that of cult figures to that of major symphonists, and popular ones at that. Both composers, of course, were confident this would happen. Mahler, as he lay dying, prophesied, "My time will yet come." Bruckner, as he accepted his disciples' urgings for revisions that would make his symphonies more digestible to their contemporaries, carefully preserved his original versions, declaring he had written them for times to come. Bruckner will be ready for the world, his biographer Kurt wrote on the centenary of the composer's birth, when the world has to flee to him for refuge. Since Wagnerian elements are remarked in many of Bruckner's works, and a citation of an actual Wagner motif occurs in the one being performed in the present concerts, it might be appropriate to consider the influence of Wagner in Bruckner's music before proceeding to the Eighth Symphony itself. Bruckner did revere Wagner. He quoted Wagnerian motifs in some of his works, dedicated his Third Symphony to him, and incorporated an elegy for him in the slow movement of the Seventh Symphony. When he finished the sketch of the Eighth, he celebrated by performing portions of it, commingled with motifs from Götterdämmerung on the organ. But the extent of Wagner's influence has to be put into perspective, and would seem to lie more in the nature of encouragement rather than that of an original model or pattern. Bruckner was 38 years old when he first was exposed to Wagner's music. The work was Tannhäuser, then given its first performance in Linz by Bruckner's young teacher, Otto Kitzler, with whom he pored over the score. The effect and its significance are described by Hans Hubert Schoenzler in his valuable book on Bruckner, and I quote, "First and foremost, it demonstrated to him that the creative impulse is greater than the hallowed rules of the classroom, that the creative genius has the right, even at times the duty, to break these rules. And then he found a wealth of harmonies, harmonies that he had dreamt of but had never dared to use." Yet it must be remembered that this great impact of Wagner's music came to Bruckner at a time when he was virtually at the end of his apprenticeship as a composer. All the main foundations on which Bruckner's great work was to rise had been laid, and this contact with Tannhäuser merely added to and enriched something which was already essentially established. Perhaps the nearest approach to the truth would be to say that as a kindred spirit, Wagner provided the stimulus which allowed ideas that were latent within Bruckner himself to pour forth. We should not overlook the fact that several of Bruckner's earlier compositions contain passages which strike one today as being distinctly Wagnerian in flavor, and that at the time Wagner's music was completely unknown to him. If we seek a deeper influence, a truer parallel, then we must look back much farther. Bruckner's musical roots, Schoenzler observes, reach back to Palestrina, to Bach, to Beethoven and Schubert, and his formal outlook is fashioned by the Baroque of St. Florian and by the Gothic of the Stadtpfarrkirche in Steyr and later of the Stephansdom in Vienna. His music contains passages of the deepest mysticism, yet he was no mystic. His symphonies contain melodies which take us back to the folk song and folk dances of Upper Austria, yet Bruckner was no peasant simpleton. In every bar of his music, he strives toward his lieber Gott, his dear Lord, searches for him in the expanse of the universe and in the narrow confines of his native countryside. And it has been said that each of his symphonies is in reality one gigantic arch which starts on earth in the midst of suffering humanity, sweeps up toward the heavens to the very throne of grace, and returns to earth with a message of peace. The Eighth Symphony is the most ambitious of the works Bruckner lived to complete. It is the towering pinnacle of his own achievement and of the particular symphonic form he created. It has all the qualities that typify Bruckner and make all of his symphonies immediately identifiable as his, and yet it is, in many ways, unique among his works. Bruckner began the sketch of the first movement early in 1884 and completed it on his 60th birthday, September 4th of that year. The Adagio was fully sketched by the following February, and on August 25, 1885, the draft of the entire work was finished. 3 days later was the Feast of St. Augustine, the patron saint of St. Florian, and Bruckner returned to the organ loft of the Stiftskirche there to perform an elaborate improvisation on themes from his new symphony and from Wagner's Götterdämmerung. 2 years later, after much revision, alteration, and general polishing, he celebrated another birthday, his 63rd, by sending the score of the symphony to Hermann Levi. And he wrote, "Hallelujah, at long last the eighth is finished, and my father in art must be the first to know about it. May it find grace." Hermann Levi, one of the most eminent conductors of his time, had been chosen by Wagner to conduct the premiere of Parsifal in 1882, and had been responsible for the success of Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. The 29-year-old Arthur Nikisch conducted the premiere of the Seventh in Leipzig at the end of 1884 and scored a modest success with it. But when Levi introduced it in Munich 10 weeks later, it was triumphant on the grandest scale, earning for Bruckner respect and recognition on a scale beyond anything he had experienced before. Naturally, Bruckner was grateful and sought nothing so much as Levi's support for the Eighth, but Levi was unable to give it. Levi's admiration for Bruckner was sincere, but perhaps the dimensions of the Eighth were beyond him. In any event, his response was negative, and because he could not bear the thought of hurting Bruckner's feelings, he did not even write to him himself, but left that task to Bruckner's devoted pupil, Josef Schalk. Bruckner was stunned. He had felt secure after the success of the Seventh and was totally unprepared for such a blow. He suffered a nervous collapse and even spoke of suicide. He knew, however, that Levi was a true friend and had acted without malice, and eventually he roused himself to undertake revisions of the Eighth and some earlier works at the urging of his friends and pupils. After revising his Third Symphony and starting work on his Ninth, Bruckner turned to the revision of the Eighth in April 1889 and completed the project the following March. The changes were far-reaching. The orchestration was enriched, a new trio was provided for the scherzo, and numerous excisions were made in all four movements, a total deletion of some 150 bars. In the 1887 score, the adagio was in its accustomed place as second movement, but in the version of 1890, the Eighth became the first of Bruckner's symphonies in which the scherzo precedes the slow movement. Another conspicuous change was made in the ending of the first movement, replacing the original orchestral blaze with a soft dying away. This quiet ending is without parallel in any of Bruckner's other opening movements. By the time Bruckner completed the revision in 1890, Levi had retired from his post in Munich. He recommended the young Felix Weingartner, who agreed to introduce the Eighth in Mannheim in 1891. When Weingartner left Mannheim unexpectedly for a position in Berlin, Bruckner was again in despair. But then the illustrious Hans Richter, who had conducted Bruckner's First, Third, and Fourth Symphonies in their respective Viennese premiere, accepted number 8 and presented it in a Philharmonic concert on December 18, 1892. The new symphony was Bruckner's greatest triumph, received enthusiastically on all sides. Emperor Franz Joseph I not only accepted the dedication of the score, but paid for its publication, and not long afterward provided Bruckner with quarters in the Belvedere, where he spent the last 15 months of his life. Less than 4 years after the premiere, at about the time of Bruckner's death, Theodore Thomas introduced the Eighth to America in a concert of his new Chicago orchestra. Like most of the Bruckner symphonies, number 8 has come down to us in a number of different versions. The 1892 score, subsidized by the emperor, had more than a few emendations by the editor, Max von Oberleitner, one of the many so-called experts who felt Bruckner's rough spots needed smoothing out. The 1887 version, unperformed until 1954, is only now about to be published in the complete edition of the International Bruckner Society. The complete edition's first publication of the Eighth in 1935 was edited by Robert Haas, who based his edition on the 1890 version, but restored, in expanding scoring, some of the material from the 1887 score, which Bruckner excised in making his revision. Finally, there is Leopold Novak's edition of the 1890 version, published in the complete edition in 1955. Where the Haas edition had been labeled original version, Novak labeled his version of 1890 and included nothing which Bruckner himself had not put into his own revision. Novak's feeling was that since the 1887 version in full was to be published in the complete edition, there was no need for mixing portions of that with the composer's own second version, as Haas had done. The Novak edition is generally favored now and is being used in the present performances.